In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum, from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark. I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and The Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker of The Week. Our special guest this week is Sarah Longwell, founder and publisher of The Bulwark. Thanks, one and all. It's great to be with you in this holiday week. We're recording a day early. And we were all set to discuss what seemed to be life getting back to something resembling normal in the nation's capital, the passage of a big relief package and the sort of omnibus spending bill, which was trumpeted as a great accomplishment. But then, of course, the orange man did a huge cannonball into the pool, and we don't know where we stand now. So, Sarah Longwell, I'm going to start with you. Do you realize that if he pocket vetoes this, the government will shut down? It will affect the election in Georgia, the runoff. It will prevent people from getting their checks before the holidays, or, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable. The military will not be funded.
Yeah, we didn't think we were going to get through the year without one last big temper tantrum in which, you know, the president does what the president does best, which is make it all about him. You know, I actually can't tell what the game is here. Is it that Joe Biden has been getting too much attention and people are starting to turn the page and he just wants to show people that he can do this, that it all comes down to him and that he can blow this up if he wants? What's interesting is that, you know, him sort of saying, well, you know, does he want to be this big magnanimous person? I want $2,000 checks for people so that he can be a hero. The problem with that theory is that he could have done this a week ago, 2 weeks ago.
Or months ago.
Months ago. And push for this. But he remained totally silent, only to blow this thing up at the last minute. And, you know, this is what I don't feel the least bit sorry for Republicans. But ultimately, you know, what does Nancy Pelosi do when Donald Trump does this? She jumps right on top of it and says, this is terrific. Yes, we would love to do $2,000 checks. Let's get it done. Well, of course, Republicans must be absolutely tearing out their hair that they had negotiated this deal, and now the president is going to make them be the ones to have to say no. Whether or not, so I guess I don't, I would be shocked if he shut down the entire government, just because it would be such a catastrophic thing to do. That being said, I don't put anything past him at this point. I think it probably has more to do with him just wanting the attention and wanting to say that he can, but you never know.
Damon, all the reports are that this negotiation went on without any input at all from Trump. Aside from the stray comment here or there, he was completely focused on his fantasy of a stolen election and meeting with the unbelievable loons and nuts, conspiracy theorists who feed him what he wants to hear in the White House. He was paying no attention. Steve Mnuchin was the chief negotiator. And it was Republicans, we heard, who resisted giving larger checks to individuals. Now Trump comes in and blows the whole thing up. Is this, you know, situation normal?
Well, it's normal for him. I mean, he does this a lot. He did it in 2018 with another, I believe it was an omnibus spending bill then as well. And he's done it in smaller doses over the years while he's been president, where he sort of hangs back, sits on the sideline while the negotiation is going on. Occasionally he'll lob little grenades into the negotiation with tweets that sort of scuttle things or send them off track for a day or two. Then they come back and the deal gets made, and then he throws a temper tantrum. And in the end, he usually just signs anyway. So I have to assume that is what he will do. And I think that in the end, the thing more than anything else that will lead him to do it is that someone will inform him that his little kind of display, his last acting out about the election that he wants to see happen on January 6th, when several members of the House Republicans are going to raise objections about the electoral count in several states, and potentially someone like Rand Paul may do the same in the Senate, which would lead, as we talked about last week, to a vote and all kinds of chaos in Congress on January 6th. That could easily get scuttled if this blows up. There's a pocket veto. The new Congress is then going to be scrambling, and no one is going to be in the mood to play these games about the election. So in order to fulfill his last-ditch fantasy of raising these questions about the veracity of the vote, I think he probably will relent so that the spotlight can be on that. And if that convinces you that Trump has the best interests of the country in mind, then, you haven't been paying attention. Because this is all I can say, you know, when I heard last night what he was doing about this deal that had just been reached, and then how and then you get Nancy Pelosi immediately doing what any competent politician would do from the other party and say, okay, great, we'd love to have $2,000 checks. Absolutely, Mr. President. You just kind of, you know, smack your forehead and say, God, the end of this cannot come soon enough. Let the circus end. So, I mean, you know, who knows how it'll play out, but let's just be absolutely clear that this is not some kind of multidimensional chess strategy going on here. This is just Trump being Trump and impulsively acting out in ways that make no strategic sense on any side.
Yeah. Linda, one of the things, you know, he released a little video, and as usual, this video contains a series of false statements. You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about, as usual. Some of the things he's complaining are in this bill are not in this bill. They were in the CARES Act that passed back in March, complaining about money for the Kennedy Center, for example. You know, I mean, isn't it remarkable how incompetent we've learned you can be as President of the United States, how completely bat-you-know-what crazy, and a significant portion of the American public thinks, no, he's good. We like it.
Absolutely. And by the way, you know, he has totally ruined the brand of the Republican Party, which even in my youth, when I was still a registered Democrat, the one thing you could count on Republicans for was competence. You know, Democrats had good intentions and, you know, wanted all the great things, but they weren't very competent at delivering them. Well, Republicans always had, at least, you know, in the past, a sense that these were responsible people. They'd had big jobs. And when they came into government, they knew how to run things. Well, he's blown all of that up, obviously. But, you know, I want to take issue with Damon, because I'm not at all certain that this isn't part of the January 6th strategy. And it isn't a matter of being, you know, four-dimensional or five-dimensional, or six-dimensional chess, whatever. It is a matter of, you know, the kind of tunnel vision that he has. I mean, one of two things may be playing in his mind. One is that he has this fantasy that if he makes this promise, that he'll deliver $2,000 per, you know, per person in this stimulus check, that then people will want him to be president again. Look at what, you know, look at what
he said that. It's in the video.
Yeah. What, you know, what will Joe Biden give you? He's going to give you a lousy $600. If you, you know, if you stick with me, I'll give you $2,000. Mm-hmm. And that may, you know, that may be part of his thinking. He may think, well, shut it all down. He didn't care if government shuts down. Why should he care? I mean, you know, he has absolutely no regard for the federal government. So I'm not at all certain that this isn't part of that January 6th ploy. I don't, you know, I don't think it's going to succeed. But there is something that could happen that could make a difference. Mnuchin could quit. Bill Barr quit. At a certain point, as much as I was a critic of Bill Barr, enough was enough, and he had to quit. Mnuchin ought to quit. I mean, if the president were, in fact, to veto this bill or even, you know, continued to fight against it, the person that he had up there negotiating on behalf of the administration has egg on his face. I mean, he's got a whole omelet spread across his face, and he ought to quit.
Linda, can I just interrupt for one quick second? Also, he's, you know, look what it does to the two Republican candidates Senate in Georgia who have also lauded this agreement.
Of course. Yeah. He doesn't care. He really doesn't care. If in the back of his head he knows that he's not going to be president on, you know, at 12:01 on January 20th, what does he care if Mitch McConnell is, you know, the head of the Senate or not? He doesn't care. He'd like Mitch McConnell to get his comeuppance too. You can see him wanting to throw the Georgia election just so that Mitch McConnell is not majority leader in the Senate. This is an utterly vindictive, psychotic behaving man. And I don't think we can have any idea what he's up to. I don't think there's any way of predicting it.
Bill, before we got started, well, and before the news broke last night about the president's video, I thought we were going to have a nice conversation about the deal and about, you know, back to business as usual, which, by the way, I have spent a career finding fault with, right? You know, I hate these little giveaways for selected industries that are always part of these big omnibus packages. You know, the motorsports entertainment industry, NASCAR, you know, gets a tax break, and the three martini lunches back for businessmen's lunches, and so on and so forth. All of these things lobbied for by individual industries and paid for by all of the rest of us. Hate all that. And yet I was prepared to say, you know, compared to the insanity of the Trump years, it's almost reassuring to have that kind of bargaining back. So I'm asking you, Bill, whether you think that we're ever going to get back to normal.
Are we ever going to get back to normal? I think that, you know, Joe Biden as president will work as hard as he can to bring that about. But he can't do it by himself. And I have no idea how beholden the Congressional Republican Party will feel to ex-President Trump's hold over a substantial portion of the Republican base. I can't do those sums. I would like to believe that the kinds of Republicans who came together and after Thanksgiving to make common cause with some Democrats in the Senate to come up with a framework for a compromise that forced the leaders back to the table, I'd like to believe that that's going to be the template for what comes next. And if I have anything to do with it, it will. But I have no confidence in any predictions that I make at this point.
But let's turn away from the prospects of bipartisan cooperation in the 117th Congress and focus for a minute or two on the remaining days of the 116th Congress, which ends on January 3rd. Some very important outcomes for the American people are going to depend on two procedural questions. First of all, the experts I've consulted tell me that the only way that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi can bring up an expansion of the individual payments that President Trump has proposed to set at $2,000 is to receive unanimous consent to proceed down that road. No one believes that House Republicans are going to give that consent. And if so, the effort to expand the individual payment will stall, at least for now. It may come back next week, but the odds seem pretty small. With regard to the broader question of the fate of the COVID-19 bill and, you know, the funding of the government up until September 30th of next year, Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution says that if the president is presented with a bill and he does not either sign it or veto it within the next 10 days, then it becomes law without his signature. This is known technically as the presentment clause, of the Constitution. Unfortunately, the bill was presented to the president a couple of days after it was enacted into law by Congress, which means that if the president does nothing, the 116th Congress will end, according to law, before the 10 days expire, which means that the bill simply evaporates and the 117th Congress would have to begin all over again with the budget and COVID relief. And in the meantime, government would have been shut down since December 28th. This is a truly terrible outcome, which the president can achieve simply by doing nothing. And I suspect that House and Senate leaders will move heaven and earth to avoid that catastrophe.
Thank you for that. That's very interesting. Before we turn to our next topic, Sarah, I want to circle back to you on one thing. Charlie Sykes had a really incendiary, wonderful newsletter this morning where he asked, you know, are you all happy, basically, of Republicans who signed on for this against all warnings? It is... I mean, you know, you've got Rich Lowry and some others, you know, saying, well, the president's behavior trying to overturn this election is really regrettable. It's really not good. But, you know, every single Republican and conservative thought leader, right, who until a few weeks ago was saying, yep, we should definitely reelect this guy. You know, it would be nice, wouldn't it, to hear at least some contrition, at least some comment along the lines of, you know, I underestimated just how crazy he could behave.
You know, Mona, it's the holidays. So I want to not indulge in too much Schadenfreude. But there is a part of me, and Charlie quotes me in his newsletter because I had a piece, and this was back in the summer, saying, you know, what did you think was going to happen, folks? You know, you elect somebody of extraordinarily low character, who constantly lies and is corrupt, you know, who wanted to be the chaos candidate, who said he was going to burn it all down. Why would you be surprised that things are now on fire? And, you know, yesterday, Trump made so much news yesterday between the pardons and blowing up the bill that one of the things that people might not have missed is he also went after John Thune, the senator from South Dakota, for daring to suggest that Joe Biden was in fact going to be the next president and says he's going to primary him in 2022. And yeah, there is, when you just watch, or the way that Trump is sort of blowing up the Republicans' negotiations on this bill, there's this part of you that says, there you go, guys. This is what you get. You have to ride this tiger now. You accommodated him until the very last breath. You have watched him turn on everybody, burn down people's careers. And what, you thought he wasn't going to come for you too? Of course he is. And then to your point, there are the folks who there's a little bit of Twitter action right now that's kind of like, I guess those Never Trumpers might have been onto something. Now that we see how this guy is acting, you know, post election, in refusing to concede, because of course we were all called hysterical, we were called unhinged for suggesting that he might behave like this, but it defies credulity to suggest that the president's post-election behavior somehow is different than everything we saw pre-election. And not just pre-election 2020, but pre-election 2016.
Right.
Like, his character has been his destiny the whole time. And I think for those of us who are sort of part of this Never Trump world, it was saying this man's character is more than deficient, and that is going to lead us to chaos, which is where we find ourselves.
Right. Yes, that just occurred to me that he makes Bill Clinton's character flaws seem like trifles by comparison.
So quaint. And
what?
Yes, all so quaint. I mean, you just think about that Mark Rich pardon, which was contemptible and done sort of in the very the last moments of the Clinton presidency, only to have just 20 Mark Rich type pardons come from President Trump to very little
and worse, and worse, because Trump pardons war criminals. He wants people to believe that war criminals are honorable and hard done by, that it's disgraceful the way they've been treated, he says, having no concept of justice, having no concept of honor, being the reverse of all of that. And, you know, part of me thinks, I look at someone like John Thune, who I used to like, and think, you know what, you asked for it. This is your just reward. Okay. So I guess I'm not thoroughly of the holiday spirit. Let's turn now to practical thoughts about reform. Now, it's going to be hard in the next period to have anything like the comprehensive reforms that we saw passed after Watergate, because Watergate was followed by a huge party change. The Democrats swept in by huge margins, and they pretty much had their discretion about how they wanted to reform things. That obviously is not true here. But I'd like us to talk a little bit about some possible reforms that might get bipartisan support, or even if they won't, things that would be helpful going forward. Now that we've seen that you cannot rely on the voters to use good judgment and only elect people who are fit for the office, that we may need to codify certain rules. So I'll go first. I think maybe we need to make it a law that any candidate for president has to release his or her tax returns. Damon Linker, what about you?
Well, the truth is that I am not an expert in these kind of process questions of how government works, so I will cede my time to Bill Galston, who does know far more about that. But I will also note that Jack Goldsmith, who was a guest on the podcast a few months ago, has co-written a book with former Congressman Bob Barr that is an entire book filled with great ideas along these lines. So I cede my time both to that book to Bill Galston.
Just a quick correction. It's with with Bear, not Barr.
Oh, sorry.
That's the co-author. Okay.
Yeah, Bear.
Sure. Bill Galston.
Where do I start? let me start with something that sounds abstruse, but isn't. You know, we all found ourselves this summer getting a crash course, frequently self-administered, in the vagaries of the 1887 Electoral Count Act, which every expert regards as so opaque and muddled as to defy easy interpretation on some of the most crucial points. So, you know, rather than starting with items that are really fresh, why don't we go back a century and a quarter and review the text of that law and, you know, and rewrite it in English and make some decisions that that law did not quite make or didn't clearly make. And one of the things that we need to do in the process, you know, is to offer and pass a law codifying the intention of the constitutional provision that gives states a plenipotentiary authority over the selection of electors, right? That, you know, that loomed as the biggest potential roadblock on the road to a normal election.
Can I interrupt for one quick sec just to clarify? One of the things that was unclear there, right, is this matter of where it says the legislatures shall have the sole authority, and it's not clear whether that excludes the governor. What about if the state Supreme Court has made a ruling about it? That sort of thing, right?
Well, that's exactly what I have in mind. To say nothing of it, the case that was, you know, the sort of the tip of the spear, namely every single legislature had passed a law saying that the electors, that state's electors, shall be awarded to the winner of the popular vote in that state. Mm-hmm. So if that law is on the books, can legislators just disregard it before or without repealing it?
Right.
And so I could go on in this vein for quite some time. There, before we get to controversial provisions that reflect today's burning controversies, let's get the basics right. So that's where I would begin.
Yeah, that's an excellent one, Linda.
That is an excellent one, and I think it absolutely needs to be clarified. Mine is more philosophical. One of the things that has...
Hey, that's my beat.
I know.
Well,
one of the things that has most horrified me during this election cycle is the pictures of armed people at state capitals, in front of election officials' houses, or marching in the streets of Washington, D.C. in order to intimidate people. And so it strikes me that, you know, we have this kind of question about the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. And I've always been one who believes that private individuals do have the right to own guns, although I think it can, in fact, be regulated sensibly. But what happens when the First Amendment and the Second Amendment clash? Because it is absolutely clear that the reason these fellows, and they are mostly fellows, show up on the streets armed to the teeth, carrying semi-automatic weapons or, you know, other gear that indicates that, you know, they're tough guys and are going to enforce their views with the barrel of a gun, not at the ballot box. The reason they do this is to try to scare people from exercising their First Amendment rights. So I'm just wondering whether or not there can't be an honest and open debate about whether the First Amendment should not trump the Second Amendment, in that you should not be able to bear arms, either, you know, particularly not open carry arms, in order to stifle speech. That, you know, the right of assembly, the right of free speech, is in fact the most precious of the rights in the Bill of Rights, and that those who attempt to interfere with the rights of others through the brandishing of weapons should not, in fact, be forbidden. And I don't know how we'd go about it. I'm just throwing that out there because I think we cannot allow it to continue that these people show up on state capitals, that they show up on people's lawns or on the streets of major cities trying to stifle speech.
Linda, do you remember in 2008, Obama's first election, there was some random guy called a New Black Panther who showed up at a polling place in Philadelphia. And he had a billy club. And the right-wing media went berserk over this for weeks. I mean, you know, it was that we have to stamp out this, you know, this revolutionary activity and these are dangerous thugs and on and on and on.
Even wearing black, I think, was enough to make these snowflakes shiver in their boots. And
exactly.
It was a huge deal on the right. I mean, it was written about obsessively.
It was one guy.
One guy.
And now you have, and he didn't have a gun. Now you have all of these armed people showing up all over the place. I mean, okay, just for the record. All right. Bill Galston, you wanted to return to something that Linda said real quick before I get to Sarah, or did you make your point?
No, just very, very quickly. There's a simpler way of thinking through this issue than trying to argue that one amendment to the Constitution is more important than another.
Okay.
I think that that will lead to a roadblock very quickly. Every single amendment to the Constitution, every one of the rights is subject to reasonable time, place, and manner regulation. So you do not have a right, to open up a revival tent at 2 a.m. in the middle of a residential area. And, states have all sorts of restrictions on the ways in which First Amendment rights can be exercised, consistent with public order and safety. So this is not a hard case, and you don't have to say that the First Amendment is more important than the Second Amendment in order to pass constitutionally permissible laws regulating the bearing of firearms near polling places.
Well, thank you for that, Bill. By the way, our producer, Jim Swift, notes that some of the new GOP House caucus members are asking Capitol Police to allow them to carry guns in Congress. So that's great. Okay, Sarah Longwell, did you want to propose a reform that you think is possible?
Yeah, mine is very simple and not at all philosophical. It is that you cannot install your family members in the White House and allow their spouses to run the executive branch.
That could never happen.
I find it just preposterous and something that everybody just sort of accepted early on, that Ivanka was going to become a White House advisor, that Jared Kushner became the center of power in that White House and did high-level diplomatic work on behalf of the United States without proper security clearance, I might add. And so this is one of those things that should be easy, should be bipartisan. I've actually got a raft of these. I am not an expert, but I have, as a conservative, long had a penchant for reigning in executive power. And I think that, understanding that so much of Trump has helped us understand how much of what goes on at the highest levels of government is on the honor system. And when you have a person who has no honor, it creates tremendous peril. And not only that, but I mean, he's an unsteady person. And so things like, war powers or emergency powers that reside with the president, those are too broad for a person like him. And so I think we should revisit those. And I also think, one of the things that we really need to guard against in the future is the ability to monetize the presidency, because it creates perverse incentives for people to seek the office. And so simple things like whether it's putting your businesses in a blind trust, as one might do with a peanut farm, things like that, that would disincentivize a bad actor, trying to juice their business by becoming president.
Right. Agree. So I would add, just there, I too have a very long list, and recommend the Goldsmith book, which is really comprehensive and very, very well done. Includes things like more protection for inspectors general and the various departments, and all of that is really great. But one of them, speaking of the other news that's breaking today, namely about these pardons, you know, this president has abused all of his powers, arguably, but particularly the pardon power. There isn't very much law on this because the courts have tended to interpret the president's authority here quite broadly. And there's never been a case before where, you know, they've been challenged to consider things like we've seen. So, for example, you know, it's not known whether the president can self-pardon. That's still to be determined. And it is, there has never been a case before, as has come up with this administration, of dangling pardons in exchange for silence. So I don't know if this could pass on a bipartisan basis, which tells you a lot about the state of the Republican Party, but it could, the Congress could pass a law making it a crime for the president to offer pardons in exchange for anything. Right? No quid pro quo. Force Republicans to take a vote on that. If they're going to say, no, we want to keep the option open for presidents to dangle pardons for lawbreakers, exchange for silence or for friends, let them say it. So that would be why. And one more, I would just say again, this is all coming from this Goldsmith book, but it's also very important in light of what we've seen. And that is, during the impeachment process way back at the beginning of 2020, which seems like a million years ago, but one of the things that the president was able to do was to defy congressional subpoenas, and the Congress elected, I think wrongly, but they elected not to litigate that in the courts. Another possible legal reform would be to expedite judicial review of congressional subpoenas if the president defies them. So these are all possibilities, and as a number of you have said, and it's right, you know, it's law is all you have when virtue fails, or as somebody once said, the law allows what honor forbids. And unfortunately, we do, though, have to beef up the law to deal with the possibility that we will have another president of extremely low character. Okay, now we'll get more in the holiday spirit, unless anybody has anything to add on that subject. Take a quick look. No? Okay, so we will move on to recommendations from everybody about things to watch over the holiday. Your favorite series or movies or music or anything. It doesn't necessarily have to be holiday themed, but things that you've really enjoyed and that have enhanced your life recently. Linda.
Sorry about that. Well, this isn't at all holiday theme, but one of the things that I really love and that I have missed enormously during the pandemic is the theater. For many years, I had season tickets to the Shakespeare Theater, and I love Shakespeare, and I love theater. And so one of the things, my recommendation is going to be a series that I think started in 2012. It's called The Hollow Crown, and it is available on PBS. And what it is a series of adaptations of William Shakespeare's plays, most of them his histories, and they're wonderful. What makes them wonderful is the acting is superb. They have some of the best Shakespearean actors doing the parts, but they are filmed as if they were movies. And so outdoor scenes are really outside on the countryside, and they're quite luscious and beautiful. Richard II starts the series, and then Henry IV, part one and part two, Henry V. And then the season two, I think, is Henry VI, part one and two, and Richard III. So it's if you love Shakespeare, And even for those who, you know, may not think they love Shakespeare, this is a very accessible way to get in it. And it's not quite like watching a filmed play. It is more like watching a film like A Man for All Seasons, which is from a play, but translated to the screen very well. So that's my recommendation.
And by the way, A Man for All Seasons was my favorite movie of all time. So
mine as well. And by the way, Thomas More is again in the news because a society named in his honor is filing all sorts of absolutely ridiculous suits in the election. So
I know, and it's a shame that they drag his name into it. But by the way, there is a different take, completely different take now that's available in the entertainment realm called Wolf Hall, which takes the character who's the villain, Thomas
Cromwell.
Cromwell, thank you. Thomas Cromwell is the villain in A Man for All Seasons and in the Moore story. In this series, he becomes the hero. So it's interesting. It's well done. Anyway, okay, let's move on to Damon Linker.
Well, I, as some listeners may know and others may not, I'm a big music guy. I write about rock music a fair amount and songwriting and things in columns throughout the year. And just this week, I offered to readers of the week my take on the best album of the year. So I will make that here as well. It's by a Los Angeles-based singer-songwriter named Phoebe Bridgers, an album called Punisher. Recorded in dribs and drabs throughout 2018 and 19. So you can't really say that she has written and recorded the album in light of the pandemic at all. For instance, Taylor Swift did exactly that. She's released two albums this year that have been written and recorded this year. But the Bridgers album fits the mood and the kind of experience of lockdown in a way that's sort of uncanny. I think it's a very good collection of songs, and the whole production of it, I think, mirrors the mood of this year in a way that is very powerful. So I recommend that to listeners. I also will note a couple of other things. One, I just recently with my wife rewatched the TV series The Americans and was just stunned once again at how great it is. I know several people, David French is a huge fan of it as well. So if you haven't seen The Americans, it's available for streaming on a number of platforms. I think it's on Amazon Prime. I definitely recommend that. Very, very well done series. And for, you know, listeners of this podcast, maybe appreciate that it's centered on the Cold War and the 1980s and Soviet spies living in America. So it's juicy in that way that the listeners of this podcast might appreciate more than perhaps some others. So I recommend that as well.
I watched it. In fact, it got me through many hours of recuperation from surgery last year. But I have to say, the body count of people that these spies wind up killing is just ridiculous. There's almost one in every episode. But anyway, it is very entertaining.
Did that not really happen in Washington in the 1980s? Like the FBI are investigating, and like every other day, there's a new dead body from the Soviet spies living right in Washington.
Yeah. And Damon, you forgot to mention that it has a wonderful music. If you lived through the 80s, you will recognize many of the songs, and they do a brilliant job of matching songs with episodes.
Yes, that's certainly true. As they march through the 80s, it starts around 81, right as Reagan is coming into the White House, and it ends in 87, right around when Gorbachev is coming to the U.S. for the big meeting with Reagan about missiles and the START treaty and so forth. So it's and yes, as Linda says, the music matches it perfectly, step by step, all the way through.
Okay. Damon, did you have anything else?
I mean, I could mention, I suppose, I'm doing a podcast on David Bowie, if anyone is interested. I'm actually, yes, I'm plugging something of my own, but I'm directing it towards something else. Political Beats is a very good music podcast that is put out by National Review, and the host invited me on to do several episodes on the career of David Bowie. We've released the first of three. It's only a little over 3 hours long. So it's incredibly long and in-depth. I mean, Bowie had a very long career, but we're taking our sweet time with it. But that is available. You can find that at the National Review website or in the Apple Podcast app under Political Beats. And I'm the guest on the Bowie episode. So if you're interested in the history of rock and Bowie or anything related to it, that might be something nice to curl up with over the holidays.
Excellent. Excellent. Listen while you bake your cookies.
Yes.
Bill Galston.
9 hours of Ziggy Stardust?
No, Ziggy's only a little at the beginning. There's so much more.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I like music of a different era. So I can recommend a series on the Great American Songbook, originating from the 92nd Street Y in New York City. For example, my wife and I just watched a sort of a cabaret-style presentation on the life and music of George Gershwin. You know, fabulous photos, excerpts from Ira's diary about writing lyrics with George, you know, young cabaret singers singing their hearts out. It was one of the few feel-good experiences I've had during this entire pandemic. Moving right along.
Was this a YouTube thing, or where did you see it?
Well, you go to the 92nd Street Y.
Their website?
Their website, and yes, you have to pay a little bit to watch, but you know what? You know, what else do we have to spend our money on?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Moving right along, I'm a huge fan of British police procedurals. You know, for a reason that a very good article in The Atlantic explained, not in the most recent issue, but the one recently passed. And that is that because the British police are basically prohibited from using violence except in dire circumstances, it's about actual detective work with really interesting characters. You know, there's a show called Unforgotten, which is a cold case show starring an astounding British actress by the name of Nicola Walker, one of my favorites, but there are many others as well. So, and finally, my wife and I are now about two-thirds of the way through The Queen's Gambit, and it's everything it's cracked up to be. The reviewer's adjective riveting was invented for this show. How you can make a riveting show about chess is beyond me, but they pull it off. It was something to spare.
Indeed. I can second that. And by the way, little promotion for our podcast, the chess consultant for The Queen's Gambit was Garry Kasparov, who is going to be a guest on Beg to Differ in early January. So look forward to that.
Yes. Well, when I was on the board for the National Endowment of Democracy, you know, Garry made a number of appearances. Mm-hmm. They were very different, but they all had something in common, namely his prediction that Putin would fall within 9 months.
Oh, well, the wish being the father to the thought, I guess. Okay, Bill, was that the end of your list?
The very end.
Okay. By the way, I'll tell you that, speaking of British police procedurals and body counts, because we were talking about the Americans, my husband and I like to watch these also, but you know, they're always set in these idyllic, you know, British countryside settings, and yet, you know, every single episode there's a murder. And when we actually were visiting the Cotswolds a few years ago, you know, our guide was saying, you know, how wonderfully peaceful everything was, and my husband said, "Oh, come on, you can't fool us. We know what really goes on in these peaceful little villages. We watch PBS." Okay, Sarah Longwell.
Yeah, it's an endorsement of Midsummer Murders right there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You know, for anybody who thinks, well, look at that, they've got that young woman there, Sarah, she might come with some new hip recommendations. I regret to inform you that all of mine are essentially foreign things that I think are for everybody, but if you don't want to watch them, you can tell your mom about them. I also just want to second the endorsement of Nicola Walker, who is in, I don't know when she sleeps, she's in every British television show.
It's true.
She's in all the shows.
Yep.
And is excellent. But here are my my two favorites. So one is The French Village, which is streaming on Amazon Prime. It is in French, and about a French village during World War II.
With subtitles.
It is the most engrossing, and look, I'm not going to lie to you. It has been a difficult time to watch things about fascism, during this moment, because you see certain parallels in the propaganda and other things that sort of make your blood run cold. But for anybody who thinks, oh my God, I can't watch something else about World War II, like, I was trying to sell my sister on this, and she was just like, I think I've had enough in my lifetime of World War II, you know, whether it's literature or anything else. And I really want to get her there, because it's sort of just soapy enough that you can get invested in the characters. But it's about this little French village that is sort of, you know, it's adjacent in some ways. But it really is about, it's a long sort of 82 episode meditation on what it means to collaborate and the degrees of collaboration and what is the moral, how do you grapple with the morality of that? And it's just fantastic. But look, if you want something lighter and funnier, I have not laughed until I've cried as much as I did at a show on Netflix called Dairy Girls. And I had a friend who kept telling me, you got to watch this. And just like, for whatever reason, I was looking at it on the algorithm, which was also pushing it on me hard, and thinking, I don't know why this just like doesn't really... It doesn't seem like I want to watch it. And then I did. And I finally, and like the first episode, it is set in the 80s in Ireland. Also sort of adjacent to, you know, the kind of terrorism that was going on at the time. And it's about these girls, in school. And there's not really a way to explain it other than it is a comedy. They're in Catholic school. And it is the kind of situational comedy. It's just so funny. I can't recommend it enough. You'll thank me if you go watch it.
Excellent. I second your endorsement of A French Village, and I know that Bill Galston agrees, because it's come up once before in our conversations. It's genius, because it takes one of the most difficult subjects and makes it, you know, not simple. It makes it more complex, right? They don't do anything cheap in this series about, you know, good guys versus bad guys, collaborators versus honorable resistance members. It's really nuanced and very clear that even people who sometimes, you know, are, you know, think that they're doing the right thing, maybe aren't. And that I thought the deepest part of it was that you watch this and you think for yourself, you know, I'm not sure where I would have fallen along that spectrum. It's very hard. And finally, I just have to add a comment that was made by my friend Danielle Frum, who said, you know, you you watch this and you have sympathy for the characters and the difficult moral choices that they have. She said, on the other hand, when you look at the people who collaborated with Trump, you think there was nothing on the line for them. There was no Gestapo. There were no consequences to them doing the right thing, and they didn't. So I think that's worth noting. All right. Sorry about my dog barking in the background. All right. So we've got Bill, Damon, Linda, we've got everybody. I guess it's my turn. I will just note that I really can recommend the series Shtisel, hard to pronounce. It's in Hebrew. It is an Israeli series. It's available on Netflix. It's about the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. And even though I'm Jewish, I have to say I'm not part of that world. And it's in some ways as alien to me as it would be to anybody who wasn't Jewish. And yet this series is so touching and so it draws you into the character so much. And it is just a wonderful piece of work. And it ends, you know, it's all tied up in a bow at the end too, which is not always the case with these series where they seem to sort of run out of steam and then peter out. This comes to a nice conclusion. So Shtisel, I recommend it.
I second that.
Ah, there we go. Okay.
I third that with the footnote that it's not over, Mona.
It's not?
No, they're going to make a third season.
Oh, that's news to me. Okay, great. Well,
something to look forward to.
Yeah, something to look forward to. All right, excellent. Okay, let us move now to our final segment, something that we want to highlight. Linda, you go first.
I wanted to highlight one of the people who was, in fact, pardoned that has not gotten as much attention. And I want to point to it because I think there may be more to this story than meets the eye. Trump, in his commutations yesterday, also commuted, in addition to war criminals and politicians and others, commuted the sentence of a man named Philip Esformus, or Esforms, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. He's a Miami Beach healthcare mogul who was convicted of playing a role in the nation's biggest Medicare fraud case. He won a commutation of his 20-year sentence. What he was convicted of was paying bribes, money laundering, and other charges. And I hope somebody tracks this down because I, you know, I looked at this and I said, this one isn't quite the same as the others. What does Trump get out of this? And so I think, as in all these cases, follow the money trail. Don't know if it's real or not, but it is interesting that this guy got pardoned. And I just wonder if there was some promise of some financial remuneration to somebody for this one.
Interesting. Okay. Damon.
Well, I am sort of known, I think, on the podcast for plugging Ross Douthat of the Times. This is probably my third time in the last year or so that I've highlighted something of his. And I actually want to go even a little bigger than one column. Ross was off for about a month after the election and didn't write. And then he came back. And since then, since early December, he's written I guess about five columns, and they all have been really just incredibly good. And two of them in particular, I want to highlight one from December 12th titled The Texas Lawsuit and the Age of Dream Politik, which is kind of about the tendency of people of both parties, the Republicans worse and more ominously, but some on the Democratic side as well, a tendency to kind of revert and absorb themselves into a kind of fantasy version of politics. And he raises very provocatively the question of at what point does the fantasy interact with and begin to bleed over into the real? And that's his very interesting and I think fruitful way of thinking about the Texas lawsuit that the Supreme Court knocked down and the tendency of several dozen House Republicans to go along with it and where that might lead. And then most recently, last Sunday, he wrote another great column titled When You Can't Just Trust the Science, about the tendency, again, of people on both sides of the aisle to – seek out authorities that can simply be trusted and kind of backing away from the need for democratic deliberation about exactly what to do in light of the science. So it's by no means Douthat saying that we should not trust the science, the experts, the epidemiologists over how to respond to the pandemic, for instance. He's not saying that at all. But he is saying that when the experts give us their opinion, it is still up to us to decide what to do with it, what policies to pursue, whether to shut down schools or bars or restaurants, and for how long, and what rules to impose. And that we can't simply be alleviated of the need for that prudential decision just because we have scientists around. And I guess the main point is to delicately say to Biden and some of the Democrats coming in that a little of the rhetoric about we just have to trust the science, follow whatever the scientists say, is a kind of dodge or an attempt to elude the responsibility that is always incumbent on legislators and other people in positions of authority. So again, great work from Ross lately, and these two columns in particular are definitely worth reading and wrestling with.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Let us now move on to Bill.
First of all, I agree with Damon about Ross's most recent column, but it gave me a cause to reflect that I had learned that point in my freshman political philosophy course at Cornell University in the fall of 1963. And we have fallen so far that when a columnist has to remind us of something that people with a modicum of education have known for centuries, we have fallen pretty far. I don't mean to take anything away from Ross, but, we have forgotten so much now that old chestnuts can emerge as new insights. But let me now recommend not a column, but a rather lengthy article by one of the best observers and analysts of democracy, Timothy Garton Ash. It's an essay that just came out in Prospect magazine, a British magazine not to be confused with the American Prospect. The essay is entitled The Future of Liberalism, and it is absolutely the most balanced treatment of the subject that I think I've ever read. It's one of those pieces where at the end I say, I wish I had written that, which, of course, calls to mind the famous story about Oscar Wilde, who was at a dinner party seated next to a friend, and somebody across the table said something insanely witty, and Wilde leaned over to his friend and said, I wish I'd said that, to which the friend replied, don't worry, Oscar, you will.
Yep, good story. And it was The Future of Liberalism, and what publication did you say it was in again?
Prospect magazine.
Prospect.
It's a British publication. I don't say this very often. It's a must-read essay.
Okay. I will read it. Okay. Well, Sarah Longwell.
So maybe I'm not on every day. Is the format we're elevating something that we've read in particular, or can you just elevate any idea?
Anything you like, and we don't always elevate. Sometimes we take shots.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to hit, just because pardons, we kind of touched on them, but we didn't sort of, dig super deep. I have been, Trump's abuse of the pardon power is something that I find particularly galling about him, because I think it reflects who he is, which is a kind of person who, the kind of strong man who would admire war criminals and like to pardon them. But I wanted to just quickly sort of highlight the way that I was seeing his pardons come through yesterday, and they seem to fit into kind of a pattern in terms of who he's pardoned thus far and who I think we could see pardoned in the future. And so I put them in three buckets in terms of who does Trump like to pardon. So the first is obviously war criminals. We saw with the Blackwater pardons that he handed down yesterday, but that is an extension of the Eddie Gallagher pardon, the Navy SEAL, whom, you know, Mona, you had an excellent piece about this at one point, where his comrades, his people in his group, they said that he was evil. And they turned on him and testified against him, which
at
is uncommon.
Risk to their own careers.
That's right. At great risk to their own careers. And those are the kinds of people that President Trump likes to pardon. So war criminals is one bucket. The other bucket is basically anybody involved in the Mueller investigation. Like, Trump is obsessed with undoing the progress that the Department of Justice made in sort of making cases against people like Flynn, or Roger Stone, or Paul Manafort. And so far, you know, we've seen Trump get off, you know, let Stone off the hook, Flynn, most recently Papadopoulos. There's another guy in there whose name I forget, but who's a little bit like Papadopoulos. But all people, you know, where it's geared toward trying to memory hole the idea that the Mueller investigation had any content in it that was, you know, actually very bad for Trump, which of course it did. So that's the second bucket, is the Mueller investigation. Then the third bucket is corrupt politicians who support Donald Trump. And so that could be Rod Blagojevich, which was an early pardon of Donald Trump's, to now Duncan Hunter and Collins, whose first name I'm forgetting, but both of them, Collins and Hunter, were two of Trump's very, very first supporters, both of whom ended up embroiled in one in a money laundering scheme and the other one in a campaign finance scam in which he blamed his wife and bought the tickets, plane tickets for the family's pet rabbit. It was going to look at, was looking at 11 months in jail.
And was also having an affair, which his wife didn't know about until this case.
Yeah, I mean, just it is going back to the Mark Rich pardon. It just each one of these individually is at the same level or not worse than that pardon, which really was a stain on Clinton's legacy, and Trump just in big batches, one by one, really disgraces the power of the pardon.
Couldn't agree more. I have a piece up on the Bulwark right now about this very subject where I revisit it. Thank you for that. I will recommend for my pick a piece that appeared in the Washington Post by my old friend Mitch Daniels, now the president of Purdue University. But previously, he was involved in the government and Republican administrations, and he most recently, I guess, was the director of the Office of Management and Budget, which is the post that Neera Tanden has been nominated for. And he writes a piece saying Republicans can take a step toward improving the atmosphere and toward comedy by confirming her. You know, he acknowledges, yes, she's been very tart and partisan and so forth on Twitter, but he says, you know, that shouldn't be disqualifying. We used to have the thought that presidents were entitled to the cabinet that they prefer, absent evidence of severe, you know, unfitness. And so he said, you know, it is time to let bygones be bygones in her case and confirm her. He said, I don't expect to agree. And by the way, as I mentioned, this is a post that he has held. He couldn't resist making a little sly comment about how in a Democratic administration, it's not even that important a post, because in Republican White Houses, the office, the director of the OMB is the one who always says, no, we shouldn't spend more money. He said that won't be an issue for Democrats. Okay, little jibe, funny. But basically, his article does have a serious point, which is that that we have to start building back toward a more civil and less rancorous politics, and that this would be a very good place to start. And it's easy for outsiders to say it, but when somebody who was a leading Republican office holder and held that very post says it, it carries a little extra weight. So good on him. We are finished with this podcast. We want to thank all of our listeners. Thanks, Sarah Longwell, for joining us. Wishing everyone an extremely happy holiday. And we will be back next week, like every week.